Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today I have Jenny Chan on the show. Jenny is the founder of the Pacific Atrocities Education Program, which explores a side of World War II history that is too often overlooked in American classrooms. Like many of us, Jenny grew up learning a version that centered heavily on Europe and the Holocaust. But through her family's experiences and years of research, she uncovered a much broader and more complex global story. In our conversation, we dig into how gaps in historical education shape the way we understand the present and why expanding our perspective, especially to include the Pacific Theater, is so important. We also talk about the work her organization is doing to bring these stories to students, educators, and the public, from archival research and oral histories to lesson plans and partnerships with schools. This is a powerful and eye-opening conversation that I think will reshape how you think about World War II and California's place in it. Let's go meet Jenny Chan. So to start, can you talk a little bit about what personal experiences and historical experiences led you to found the Pacific Atrocities Education Program?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I was actually born in Hong Kong, and my grandma would always tell me about occupation of Hong Kong during World War II. But when I was going to school in the U.S., when I was learning about World War II, I had only learned about really about the Holocaust, and 90% of it was like Hitler. And we watched only one movie about Pearl Harbor. And little did I realize at the time that Pearl Harbor and like occupation of Hong Kong were the same war. And so, sorry. And so if you think about it, it's interesting. And when I was like a kid, my mom would tell me like, oh, you know, you need to stop watching anime in front of your grandma, because my grandma would get like really triggered whenever I was watching anime. And she was telling me, oh, these people are evil. You shouldn't really watch these kind of brain rot content. And I remember one time my mom, like, grandma came over to our place, and my grandma was so triggered by like my box of manga comic books that she even tossed out like my whole box of manga. And after she passed away, I realized that we found like a box of military yen and like just stuff from her wartime experience, like military yen and like rice rationing coupon. And that's when I realized that, oh, maybe grandma went through some pretty terrible time. And at the time, like after she passed away, I was working this like really boring corporate job, and I had a lot of time to read like The Death Factory and The Rising Sun by John Tolan and The Rape of Nanking, of course. And I realized that this was a really long war that China had endured, and like my grandma had endured like the last 4 years of it just in occupation of Hong Kong. And she had that kind of lasting experience, that lasting traumatic experience that she still talked about it for the rest of her life. And that's when I realized that there's like this big gap between what we know about World War II and what people experience. And
can I jump in real quick, Jenny?
Yeah.
I had a similar experience in my K-12 education where it feels like I got the Opium Wars, and then the next thing I heard about with China was Mao. And so there's this giant gap and this major important historical period that's really just missing. And you just pick up post-World War II rise of communism in conjunction with the Cold War, and you miss a lot of the things that occurred in the Eastern theater, quote unquote. So can you talk a little bit about what the core mission of the organization is, education-wise?
Yeah, definitely. So the core mission is to really teach younger generation about what had happened between, like you said, between like Opium War to like the rise of Mao. Like China has suffered, if you think about it, over a century between the Opium War and the rise of Mao, and they call it the century of humiliation. And we don't talk about it like that. And then we talk about the rise of Mao, and then we just think about China evil. But then we don't really think about what had, and also from your last one of your episodes, you were talking about Chinese Exclusionary Act. And if you think about it, Chinese people were like excluded in the United States since 1882. And then by the time Pearl Harbor happened, that is our greatest ally. And but we don't really talk about that in school. And so we're taught, so our organization is really researching between 1931. We really focus on between 1931 to 1945, because that's like the time period when World War II really happened in Asia. And we were the first ones to actually research and actually come up with a book in English about the Kwantung Army, which was responsible for the invasion of Manchuria. And what's interesting is also like we learn a lot about Mussolini and also Hitler, but we don't think about when Japan occupied Manchuria, and all they did was walk out of the League of Nations, and that's in 1933. And so when we think about when they walked out of the League of Nations, kind of Mussolini and Hitler kind of saw that was like, and they were like, oh, we can just do that. And so by sidelining what had happened in Asia, I think we miss out on a lot of this global perspective. And so our organization is focused on more like research and also telling the stories that had happened between 1931 to 1945.
Yeah, I think it's. I talk to a lot of historians as part of this podcast, and there's a lot of trends in history. And one of them is this concept of transnational and starting to see the connections between different parts of the world, different parts of continents. And when we have major gaps, the consequence is that we misunderstand things in the present, right? We have gaps in the past. And I want to, before we get into kind of content questions about the work, I want to talk about your work with educators and students. A lot of the things that your organization is focused on, atrocities, can be really complex to teach. And so there's a lot of reliance on educators presenting things in ways that are digestible, that are appropriate, that are sensitive to the trauma and the history. How do you work with educators or staff in how they communicate about these things to make sure they're taught in a way that's both digestible but also sensitive to the subject matter?
Definitely. We definitely work with educators and we distribute our lesson plans and we try to get their input as much as possible so that they can actually teach it in their classrooms without being w with sensitivity. And a big part of what we do is about Unit 731, which was this human experimentation program, because it was so crazy that at this time of like science advancement, there was no ethics in a way. And so we do that. And so we have this big lesson plan with that teaches ethics for science. What if science was going on without ethics? And that's what you end up having with something like Unit 731. And we also had students who actually reached out and use our content for that to enroll in National History Day.
Oh, fantastic.
And yeah, and last year, a group of high school students won like first place in New Mexico in the state competition. And they were telling me that when they were showing their documentary, no one had known about the subject matter. And these are like very educated people that were judges for their National History Day. But yeah, and so students are actually actively on our website learning about this part of history as well.
Fantastic. One more question about teaching. So, we're in California. When you look at California state standards, California history is in fourth grade, and then they get another batch of US history in eighth grade, and then another batch in 11th grade. So, if you were looking at standards and thinking about where we could expand the scope of understanding in Pacific theater issues, but just br more broadly in Chinese history, do you think 11th grade is that year and that's where you would su make suggestions for how to make our curriculum more global?
I think I learned world history in 10th grade
Yeah,
in
true. Yeah, world
California.
history. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think California also just passed a bill, SB 472, And the bill established a grant program to help schools teach about the Holocaust and other genocides. But like I said, and I was even asking this for students who are doing the National History Day, I was asking, like, do you feel like a lot of what you learn in school is still very Western-centric and about Holocaust 90% of the time? And they agree that it's about Holocaust. So I feel like other genocides maybe need to get some kind of fair share in this kind of resources. And so then we can have a more well-rounded and more standardized genocide curricula.
Let's transition to talking about the research work, which your organization has also done a lot of. According to your website, you guys have worked with over 1 million pages of archival documents at the U.S. National Archives, which that's a lot of work. I'm curious, what was surprising or interesting in doing the archival work that you didn't expect going in?
Yeah, so I was really naive. I thought that going into like scanning pages would be that they're organized very
Oh,
neatly.
yeah. Disorganization. I'm a librarian. I know about this.
And that you can just go in with a topic and then they'll just give you whatever boxes you need. And then you can go through and like resources would be scanned very would be already scanned for you, and like you don't have to look into whatever. But in reality, if you're looking for a topic related to POW, right, it could be at forced labor session. It could be at some kind of random OSS paper that they have some intelligence on. And so then what started out as I was thinking, oh, maybe I can just have a 2 weeks like project on related to Unit 731 and then also all of this like biological weapons research. It turned out to be like almost at least three times of going to the National Archives, and there's three of us like scanning for I think a total of that must have so like that was a total of 4.5 months if you think about it, like, all three of us scanning. And so it was a lot more work than I had initially expected, because and also it's very frustrating because a lot of this paper were also crumbling and not very well preserved in a way. And so then I'm touching like this 80-year-old very fragile paper, and and then I was even asking the question, like, is there any do you guys have any priority to digitize this or preserve this in any way? And they're like, it's aged, but you can still scan it and it's okay. And I learned that like the Civil War, like they had used cotton papers. Versus like in World War II, they use it like this compound material. So then it's more fragile, and it's more fragile than even the Civil War paper.
Wow. Your organization also does oral histories. Can you talk about how those are generated and the process behind them?
Yeah, so in 10 years ago, I visited these women in China who were comfort women, and I had never heard about Chinese comfort women. I had only seen like Korean comfort women on the news, if I even saw that. And comfort women were like the sex slaves of World War II. And when I visited them, I went to this part of China I've never been to, and I was recording what they were saying, and I'm thankful that I did it in 2015, because had I done it now, most of them would not be alive.
Yeah.
And in researching this, it was very shocking, just because like how they had suffered just in the wartime, and also in like in and then after the war, because in Asian culture they don't talk about that kind of topic is taboo. And so they don't really talk about that. And so it was, and so then you realize that these people suffer so much. And then after the war, they still get discriminated by their own community and whatnot. Yeah, like I interviewed them in 2015, and it took me like 2 years to really absorb and digest what they were saying to me to actually like able to write this historical fiction about their experience. And in 2017, we also Stacy mostly visited the Central Coast, and she realized that there was like a bunch of Panay guerrilla fighters that were in World War II and had fought. against the Japanese with no resources. And they end up all immigrating to California. And so she spent like a whole year just integrating with them. And she even went to on their couch and watched TV with them.
That's how you really
Because,
bond.
right, because in order to like really collect oral history testimonies, especially, and talk about people's like really traumatic experience, you really need to spend your time with them. Because if not, then it's like, why should they trust you, right? And she collected like a lot of these women's experience, and she published it with us, Panay Guerrilla Fighters. And it's mostly about how these women fought the Japanese, because MacArthur was like, I shall return. But then within those 2 years, 2 years and a half, there was basically no resources being spent to fight the Japanese from the Philippines, since the Philippines was a colony of the US. And it was so interesting to me too, to listen, to read what she was writing about, because some of these like women were saying like, oh, when the Japanese arrived, we thought we were getting liberated. We were so thankful that we were going to be liberated from like the American colonists. But then they realized that the Japanese were way more brutal than the Americans ever were. And so then they instead fought alongside of the Americans. And so then that really gave me perspective of, wow, they have really been under colonization for so long. Yeah.
And so you're describing this kind of vast repository of archives and oral histories. How do you think about like areas of emphasis in your organization, like what you choose to make lesson plans with? Like, how do you choose the emphasis amidst this like vast library of experience?
Yeah, so that's a great question because the experience is like from 1931 to 1945. And so it's really what we have scanned on hand.
Yeah, convenience.
Sometimes it's like what we already have, but sometimes it also depends on what literature gap there is out there. There's a huge literature gap in like the warlord era and also in the Kwantung Army, how like Japan really invaded China. And so then we started looking into the Kwantung Army and also that era of warlord era. And it's very interesting that we were the first one. If you think about it, it's been 1931 into 9 is almost like 100 years. And we were like the first ones to like research into the Kwantung Army and the invasion of China by Japan.
Wow. I'm curious. Imagine someone teaches your lessons, reads a lot of the projects, listens to oral histories that you provided. How do you think that would change a typical American that's gone through K-12 education? How do you think it'll change their perspective on World War II? What, because we have a narrative that's often generated from film or popular books, but what do you think your work will do to alter people's perspective on World War II? How will it change? If you were to try to encapsulate that in like a new kind of like narrative or log line for World War II, what's it going to do to people's perspective, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think what it does, it shows that there is a lot of global suffering in World War II. It's not just European side. It's also like just China alone. The low estimate is 30 million people who died from World War II.
Wow.
And if you think about it, then and Rape of Nanking is very gruesome, but that's only like a drop in the bucket of what China experience, and which is crazy to me. And when I'm thinking about it, and like the whole Asia is like the low estimate is like 35 million. And so, in thinking about that, it really teaches a more of a global perspective of human experience, I think.
Yeah. I want to jump into some kind of California focused questions now. In what ways can Californians connect better with Pacific Theater World War II history? And there's a lot of connection points to California's history and World War II history. So we have great places to visit. They were unfortunate places, what happened there, but places like Manzanar, they can connect to that part of World War II. What other ways can Californians connect better to that part of World War II's history?
Yeah, actually, there are a lot of points from California, if you think about it, the lighthouse, for one example, because of the naval use. And then if you think about USS Hornet from Alameda Bay, it's also very connected in World War II history. Doolittle raid that happened right after Pearl Harbor was sailing on USS Hornet from Alameda to close to Japan in order to like attack Japan's mainland. And what's also interesting is that I was interviewing these people in like in the Zhejiang province who were actually affected by Unit 731. And then when I was doing further research, I realized that they were attacked by Unit 731 as a revenge of the Doolittle raid, because they were helping the Doolittle raiders to get out of because the only way to get out of China was to basically either get out of Japan was to either fly to China or fly to Russia, or you're really announced dead because of how brutal it was at the time. And so a lot of the Doolittle raiders flew to China to and got saved by these Chinese villagers. And then the Unit 731 sprayed the Chinese villages with anthrax and glanders. And these people, while they were working on their farmland, they were then contracting this disease of glanders and anthrax that caused their limbs to basically fall off. And yeah, that's like the more severe cases. And like some of the other cases were like skin grafting, were like skin falling off, and like it never healed until 2014, when this like when the hospital finally realized that they can do skin grafting to like basically heal from anthrax and glanders. And
Wow.
so I think like Alameda USS Hornet is like a really good point to learn about Doolittle Raiders and also see the perspective from also the Pacific. And also I think Operation Cherry Blossom at Night, which was scheduled on like September 22nd in 1945. And so then if the war hasn't ended 5 weeks earlier, San Diego or San Francisco would have been attacked by like biological weapons. And so it's, and these are like plague infected fleas that they were planning to drop basically in California. So I think California has like a lot more connection to like the Pacific War than we like think about. And also right now it's the springtime. And if you go to Fresno, there's like this
Yeah,
Fresno
Fresno, there we
Trail.
go.
Yeah. And then they put their statue. I don't know if you've been to the Fresno Almond Trail. There's like a little statue that says like the incarcerated camp that was, yeah, that happened there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm very familiar with that. I have a few more questions. I would be curious to hear you talk about your kind of connection points with universities and academics and scholars. Or is that what kind of partnerships or what kind of work do you do with the kind of broader academic world, not K-12, universities and research departments?
That's a great question. So we have a few partnerships with a few history departments. So they send us interns over the spring and over the summer for research projects. And we're currently researching more on Southeast Asia and also World War II. And we also have established a few of our past summer interns are now professors and like scholars in the field. So yeah, I think we're also training like the next generation of academia.
Yeah, so that's one impact. I'm curious more broadly, what have you seen, and maybe this can be in the form of anecdotes or stories, but what have you seen in terms of the impact that your educational programs have had on students and the broader public?
Yeah, so when we first started, I was talking to this woman who survived World War II, and she lives in California. She's a professor at Sonoma State. And I was asking her, like, hey, you want to, we're doing a lecture in with the Holocaust Center at the Day of Learning. Do you want to come by and talk about like your survivor experience? And she's, I don't know, I haven't really talked about it in public. And but she did it. She came by and she did it anyway. And like she was crying so hard, I didn't even know what to do. And apparently she didn't even talk about this like her experience for the last 50 years. Her late husband like brought her to a movie theater when and talked about and they were watching a movie about World War II, and she was crying so hard that her husband was like had to carry her to her car to the car to drive home. And it's like that kind of experience that really. And last year we had a conference and she came by and she talked about her World War II like survival experience, and she had even lost a brother, her younger brother from World War II. And she was okay. She had dropped like one tear and that was it. She is like healing. And I can see it. I can see that we're helping survivors heal and in that. And also, like telling people about what had happened to them in World War II.
I've got one more question for you before we talk about book recommendations. I'm curious, there's a lot of different organizations. I'm thinking about a lot of the organizations that I've talked with that are advocating on the behalf of land back programs for Native Americans in California. There's a lot of different organizations that are trying to educate in order to advocate. And I'm curious for you, what have you learned about the advocacy side of your work? What is effective in terms of communication and approach and working with people and trying to advocate for changing history standards, expanding history standards, or expanding history education, include a broader scope? Can you give us some kind of like broad kind of like lessons that you've learned about approaching advocacy?
Yeah, I've learned that there's this kind of really biased way of thinking in America. You have seen this lately? I cannot imagine, for example, I cannot imagine being Jewish and being on social media today.
Oh my God.
Every comment is it's so ridiculously crazy. And I was joking with my Jewish friend that like we take turns in being discriminated, and that's why our Christmas is so phenomenal.
I get a little depressed when I look at those comments as well. And like in my inside, I'm just hoping and praying that most of those are just AI bots, because if those are actual people, it's just my heart breaks for the ignorance going on there. 'Cause I don't know. It's hard to think about.
And it's very hard to think about too, that if you think about it too, right? Like America have been long colonizing and like starting wars before Jewish people, before Israel was even established. Where and Teddy Roosevelt went over to the Philippines for and like waterboarded and killed 400,000 Filipinos in order to colonize the Philippines. And so was Teddy Roosevelt Jewish? No. So and like sometimes when I talk about like when I advocate for like even wider a perspective of like teaching history, then people are like, oh, but China bad. And I'm like talking, but I was trying to talk about warlord era of China,
Do people say,
okay?
but
And
China bad?
yeah, like they would talk about CCP, and I was saying CCP didn't even exist in like 1931 if you
Oh
think
my
about it.
God.
And it wasn't even a thing. It wasn't even a
Oh.
ruling party. And everything just and so it's like this like brain fog that I'm trying to cut through. I don't know, I'm joking about it now, but it's a lot. And by providing context and by providing that, hey, I'm talking about a time that when US actually worked with China, then they're like, oh, and a lot of people are confused about that, like when I talk about that, because it's just like we have this perception that China bad and like Mao China. And yeah, it's, yeah, but so I think that is the biggest challenge of our work.
Absolutely. Jenny, we close these podcasts every time with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners about this subject or anything we've talked about today?
Yeah, The Flyboys by James Bradley is really good. The Imperial Cruise also, it's inspired a lot of our research, also by James Bradley. I also recommend The Rise of the Kwantung Army by Quinn Cho. And what I was talking about earlier with the Central Coast, the Panay guerrilla fighters, I think that would be a really good by Stacy Salinas. Of course, any book by Kurt Vonnegut is
What's your
great.
favorite Kurt Vonnegut book?
Slaughterhouse-Five.
Yep.
Yeah, what's your favorite Kurt Vonnegut?
Probably Cat's Cradle, but Slaughterhouse-Five would be a close second for sure.
Yeah, Cat's Cradle would be a close second too for me.
Jenny, to close, where can people find out more about Pacific Atrocities Education? And then do you have events or things on the horizon that people should know about?
Yeah, they can find us on our website, pacificatrocities.org, or YouTube, Pacific Front Untold.
Fantastic. And do you have anything on the horizon you want to share about events or new releases of programs or anything?
Our summer internship program is coming up, so if people are interested in applying, or if a department is interested in being a partner, just reach out.
Okay, Jenny, this was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.